somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation.
Episode 12, Expert Opinion with Teresa Bijan. Teresa Bijan is Associate Professor of Political Theory at Oriel College, Oxford University, and specializes in early modern English and American political thought. Dr. Bijan is not only one of the smartest thinkers on the history and theory of free speech, she is also the author of Mere Civility, Disagreement and the Limits of Toleration from Harvard University Press 2017. And it's one of the most challenging and rewarding books on the early modern clashes over tolerance and free speech that I've read, and I strongly recommend you buying it. It's available from Amazon, including in a Kindle version. Teresa, it's a real honor to have you on the podcast. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Your book centers on two intellectual superstars and a forgotten hero of the 17th century, and how these thinkers embody different conceptions of tolerance and the limits of permissible religious speech. But before we deal with Hobbes, Locke, and Williams, I think it would make sense with some background and context, because the English Civil Wars loom large as a cataclysmic event for these writers. And in the last episode, I only covered England up to and including Elizabeth. So could you perhaps briefly take us through why the question of religious persecution and tolerance were so crucial to the events of the Civil Wars?
Sure. So when we talk about the English Civil Wars, we're talking about a series of armed conflicts that took place in England and Scotland and Ireland from about 1642 to 1651. And it's really important to remember that these were some of the bloodiest conflicts in British history. The death toll and the casualties in these conflicts were I think, exceeded those of the world wars per capita. So really, it was an incredibly devastating time. And on the surface, what seemed to be at stake was a conflict, a kind of constitutional conflict. So the two sides were Parliament and its supporters on the one hand, and then the king and his royalist supporters on the other. And the culmination of these conflicts famously was the execution of the unfortunate King Charles, execution by beheading in 1649, and then the establishment of a republican form of government in England under what became known as the English Commonwealth. But of course, the Commonwealth itself only lasted for a few years before being replaced by the Protectorate under Oliver Cromwell. So on the surface, we often think of this conflict as being sort of the first birth of modern liberty, right? The assertion of the rights of the people and their representatives against a tyrannical crown. Before the outbreak of war in 1642, Charles had been ruling without parliament for about 11 years. And so, it's this idea of a revolution against tyranny that really captures the public mind. And I think a lot of people think about today. But for our purposes, what's really important to remember is that the Civil War was as much a religious war as it was about politics or constitutional matters. So in effect, it was the kind of climax of religious divisions that had been working their way through the English system since the English Revolution about 100 years before. And so basically, at bottom, the conflict was between those English Protestants within the Church of England who felt that the Reformation had not gone far enough, So these people were by and large strict Calvinists, and they objected, among other things, to the persistence of bishops in the Church of England, which of course was an Episcopal church. They were also pretty strict on matters having to do with predestination, objected to the ornate ceremonies that still characterized worship in the English church. So basically these people, you know, felt that for all the talk of Reformation in England, really the Church of England had not sufficiently purified itself of its kind of Catholic origins, its Catholic associations. And so these people began to be known by their opponents as Puritans, right? So those within the Church of England who felt that the work of Reformation had not gone far enough. So in addition to parliamentary objections to Charles's tyranny in the 1630s, what was also at stake was a conflict about the character of the Church of England. So Charles, in addition to kind of lacking the finesse that, you know, Elizabeth I had, and also his father, James I and VI of Scotland, for sort of massaging these tensions within the national church, Charles, you know, lacked their prudence, but he also gave the impression of being kind of soft on popery, soft on Catholicism. And the fear just gains ground over the course of his reign that, in addition to having tyrannical pretensions, Charles is kind of leading the church back to Rome. And so it's that fear of a kind of encroachment of tyranny on the one hand and popery on the other that leads to this outbreak of violence in 1642.
Mm-hmm. Another thing in this period is that pamphlets start to appear. And in 1641, the infamous Star Chamber is abolished. And so for a few years, there's no centralized censorship in England. Can you tell us a bit more about the consequences of loosening the grip of licensing?
So there's a kind of infamous decree of Star Chamber in 1637, declaring that, you know, all schismatical, seditious, and offensive books will be suppressed and their authors punished. And so the idea that Charles and Laud had been working together to censor and suppress the press was very much one of the kind of motivations for the parliamentarian side. And sort of the emblematic instance of this was the trial and punishment of a man called William Prynne, who in 1637, so leading up to the Star Chamber decree, he had been convicted of sedition and mutilated and branded for his trouble. So the Star Chamber ordered that his ears be cut off, his nose slit, and he was branded with an S and L on each cheek, standing for seditious libeler. Right. So one of the first acts of Parliament then, the Long Parliament in 1641, as you say, is to abolish Star Chamber, which has really become the symbol of Stuart oppression. So there's been a kind of push by revisionist historians in recent years to sort of challenge the idea that censorship was in fact so strong or vicious under Charles. I mean, Prynne is obviously an exceptional case, but for the most part, the work of licensing under the Stuarts and also under Elizabeth had been mostly about securing the monopoly of the London Stationers' Company. So it wasn't really the crown that was trying to suppress dissent. It was London printers who were trying to secure their exclusive rights to operate presses, right? So this is issue of monopoly. But whatever the motivations, certainly one of the most profound changes that comes with the calling of the Long Parliament is the abolition of Star Chamber. And you can see the effects of this just really concretely, just in the volume of publications. So by some estimates, you know, there are about 22 pamphlets published in the year 1642. There are, you know, almost 2,000. Right. So it's the volume. It's the fact that theological tracts that had been circulated clandestinely in manuscript form during the 1630s begin to appear because now there's no one suppressing them and their authors feel able to let them go. So you have, you know, the emergence of a sort of suppressed but rather highbrow theological conflicts. But then you also have this fluorescence of more popular and democratical sort of printing. So, I talk a bit about my book, just this fluorescence of people following Luther's example, right? Inventing their passions, experimenting with various forms of religious insult, not just experimenting with words, but also experimenting with images. So you get these wonderful woodblock prints of, you know, sort of scatological illustrations of what, you know, one's religious opponents have gotten up to. So it's a really incredible time, but it's also a very short time. So, you know, Star Chamber's abolished in 1641, and already by 1643, the Long Parliament has then comes to pass its own licensing order to try to put the genie back in the bottle.
And this is where John Milton appears on the stage. He only has a cameo in your book. He publishes his famous Areopagitica in 1644 against licensing. You have written a lot on Milton, so I thought this might also be a good time to explore his ideas and impact before we return to the main characters of your book.
Yeah, wonderful. I mean, as you say, Milton kind of gets short shrift in my book, but I got my start as an early modernist and thinking and writing about Milton. So of the figures of this period, Milton is one of the best known, right? He's the author of Paradise Lost. He's one of the greatest English poets of all time. But it's important to remember that during his lifetime, John Milton was more famous, or rather notorious, for his prose as opposed to his poetry. So he really gets his start as a pamphleteer in this moment in the early 1640s. Before Areopagitica, he had really been making a name for himself, you know, kind of an infamous name for himself as a defender of divorce. But in any case, in 1644, Milton comes out with this really incredible pamphlet called Areopagitica, which is a reference to the ancient Athenian orator Isocrates and his own work called Areopagiticus, which I can say a little bit more about in a minute. But basically, in Milton's tract, he fashions it as a speech to Parliament, lamenting their adoption of licensing and reviving the policy of licensing that they had abolished just a few years before. And it's a really it's a real tour de force. I mean, I would encourage your listeners to go read it, because it really stands up.
Let me give a famous quote for it. He writes, "Give me the liberty to know, to utter, and to argue freely according to conscience above all liberties." As I understand it, he really is the first person at this point, in England at least, who argues in favor of free speech as some sort of principle. We can come back to how principled he really is, but is that correct?
Yeah, I think I think that's fair. I think what's exceptional about Milton, as is often the case, people who had objected to the Stuart and Laudian licensing regime and censorship, you know, their objection wasn't to licensing and censorship as such. Their objection had been to just, you know, to who was doing the censorship and who was being censored, right? All sides could agree that the press needed to be controlled, but, you know, they just objected to the fact that their enemies happened to be the ones controlling it. And so Milton really makes a lot of use of this in Areopagitica, but also in his other writings, where he talks about how the new presbyter is the old priest writ large. And what he means by that is that the Puritans in Parliament, many of whom are Presbyterians, have basically seamlessly stepped into the shoes and adopted the tyrannical policies, you know, he'll say prelatical, but of the Episcopal Church before them, and through them, through the Catholic Church. So the first part of Areopagitica is dedicated to tracing the origins, as Milton describes them, the origins of modern censorship to the Catholic Inquisition. So this is an example of what you talked about in a previous episode of the idea of the Black Legend, the idea that Inquisition and censorship were an invention of the Catholic Church. And Milton is adamant that these, no such regime existed in the ancient republics of Greece or Rome, and that really this kind of inquisitorial spirit is a kind of Catholic or anti-Christian, as you know, because obviously the Pope is the Antichrist, because again, we're good Lutherans here, or a popish innovation. And so Parliament, in reviving the policy of licensing, is basically backsliding and inviting the kind of spirit of Catholic intolerance into the heart of this new regime of liberty.
As I understand it, at least, no one really paid that much attention to Areopagitica at the time. It was sort of mostly ignored. So when and why did it become so famous later on? Because it's still seen as sort of a fundamental early defense of free speech celebrated very often.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it's one of these, familiar ironies of early modern intellectual history. But yeah, so I mean, Areopagitica appears in 1644. I mean, it's really exceptional just to think about Milton's own courage in publishing it at the time. Of course, he's publishing it at a time when licensing is once again the law of the land. And he's publishing it unlicensed. So he publishes it through a clandestine, unlicensed printer, but he publishes it with his own name on the title page. It's published as Areopagitica, a speech by Mr. John Milton. So you just think about the courage that that Milton had in doing so. But for all his courage, of course, no one really took much notice. They were much more concerned about his scandalous writings on divorce. So really, the future of Areopagitica is a function of a kind of later history. So Milton and his pamphlets are taken up at the end of the 17th century and throughout the 18th century by the party that will become known as the Whig Party. And so the Whigs have a sense of themselves as being the inheritors and defenders of liberty in the tradition of the Republicans during the English Civil War. And they really treat Milton as kind of one of the patron saints of Republican liberty. And it's through that transmission, it's sort of, you know, the revival of Milton by English Whigs, and then through them to the American colonies. So Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson are huge fans of Milton and quote from Areopagitica, that really then elevate this particular text to one of the kind of canonical texts of the liberal tradition and of freedom of speech.
You mentioned that Milton goes back in time, talks about ancient Athens, Rome as examples of the virtues of free speech, and the Catholic Church with its Inquisition. An index is the antithesis of free speech and liberty. Mm-hmm. But Milton was hardly a free speech fundamentalist himself. He writes, "I mean not tolerated popery and open superstition." And he also writes basically that you shouldn't tolerate what is impious or evil, absolutely either against faith or manners. So what were the red lines for Milton? Because they seem not to be very, very lax.
Well, this is an important point, and it's one that you've touched on very well before in the podcast, that for any of these writers, I mean, no matter how tolerant they might seem, it's a matter of perspective, right? From the perspective of kind of modern secular liberalism, a lot of what, you know, passes for tolerant at the time doesn't seem all that tolerant to us. But I think Milton's a particularly interesting case because, as you alluded to, Areopagitica is fashioned as an homage to the traditions of free speaking of ancient Greece, and in particular, the idea of parousia. So the epigraph for the pamphlet comes from Euripides' play The Suppliants, and it's this idea of the essence of Athenian freedom is the freedom of speech. And Milton himself, in putting his name on the tract and fashioning it as a speech to Parliament, is himself modeling the role of the parousiastes, the man who speaks truth to power. And he makes a lot of the fact that there was no Inquisition, there was no censorship in ancient Athens or ancient Rome. really what's at stake in Area Pagitica for Milton, and this then informs the limits of his toleration, as you've mentioned, is that the you need a free press, or rather you need an unlicensed press, because that's what's essential for the cultivation of virtue in your Christian republic. In order to have a virtuous populace, you need to have a system whereby individuals are free to exercise their conscience, exercise their reason, and make their own judgments. So he says at one point in the pamphlet, you know, I abhor a pupil teacher, right? The idea of licensing is that everything is basically, everything is subject to the whims, is dependent on the arbitrary power of the censors. As opposed to allowing individual men the opportunity to cultivate their reason and their virtue and decide for themselves. But what this means for Milton, though, is that, you know, it's not really censorship as such that's the problem. It's licensing in particular. And by that, he means basically what we think of today as just prior restraint. Milton has no objection to books and pamphlets once published, then their authors being prosecuted for things like libel or blasphemy. And so it's here, really, it's in that context that we then have to understand Milton's own sense of kind of the limits to toleration, the limits to a free press, and in particular, the idea that all of the problems he's pointed out with licensing, the kind of slavish mental disposition, the fact that we won't think for ourselves, etc., these are also problems with Catholicism itself. And so, you know, he argues for a wide range of toleration, but he's really emphatic that that does not mean that we tolerate the Catholic religion. We don't tolerate popery. We don't tolerate anti-Christianity, because that religion is just another way of inculcating this sort of slavish, vicious, dependent mindset. You know, he describes it at one point as a kind of intellectual thraldom. And so for Milton, the freedom of the press and the freedom of speech is just the flip side of our duties to God to exercise our conscience and to be good and virtuous Christians.
He writes that he has no problem with books being burned mm-hmm. when they transgress those lines. I mean, is it too uncharitable to say that, you know, Milton mentions the ability of discovering truth, but unlike John Stuart Mill, later on, truth to Milton means basically Protestant Christianity, and therefore free speech is not so much about discovering new and evolving truths or approximating the truth, as Mill would say, but about vindicating the truth already revealed by God in Scripture. Is that too narrow a reading of him?
I think it's not quite fair, because Milton is really emphatic in Area Pagitica that the reason that that prior restraint is a problem is precisely because new ideas and innovations are precisely how we discover truth. And of course, you know, this is a good Protestant thing for him to say, because the innovation of Protestantism was quite recent, even if 100 years before. But I think it is fair and indeed really crucial to remember that for someone like Milton, as opposed to someone like Mill, truth isn't open-ended. Truth is God's truth. And, you know, our liberty is always constrained by God's law. And our rights are just the flip side of our duties to God. And so there's much less of a sense of, you know, the goodness of diversity for its own sake that you get in someone like Mill. And I think just remembering that, you know, Milton's position is theologically grounded is really essential to getting him right. But I would argue, and perhaps we'll come back to this later on in the interview, but just I would argue that doesn't necessarily mean that Milton's position is more restrictive than Mill's, that there is something, you know, that it's possible to kind of adapt these Christian defenses of liberty of conscience and freedom of speech in a way that I think actually could be quite attractive to modern audiences.
Of course, Milton was not the only one who favored relatively harsh laws against religious insults, or at least wrong speech, if you like, on religious issues. I detail a number of those in 16th century England, but it's also interesting that in what would become the United States with its First Amendment, the colonies actually had quite a number of quite restrictive laws. Could you briefly mention some prominent examples of that and what that meant for religious freedom and religious speech in the American colonies?
Absolutely. Again, it goes to this idea that Milton is quite exceptional for making a principled case against the regulation of printing in 1644, because it really is the common position and just common sense that you're not only going to have to restrict printing, but also regulate speech if you want people of different religious persuasions to live together in reasonably close proximity without killing each other. And so one of the things that I talk about in my book is the fact that, you know, restrictions on speech, specifically restrictions on religious insult, are not just to be found in the officially intolerant societies of, you know, of England or France or Russia, but that actually you get religious insult statutes, which are very similar to modern hate speech laws, in the officially tolerant colonies of British North America. So some of the most striking examples come from the colony of Maryland, so the Maryland Toleration Act of 1650, I have to double check that. But the Maryland Toleration Act famously prescribes a remarkably ecumenical list of religious slurs. So words like Jesuit, Jesuited Papist, Protestant, Popish Priest, Calvinist, and also just partisan labels like Roundhead and Cavalier. You know, it bans this long list of words, but you get similar statutes in Pennsylvania, which is famously a Quaker colony founded by William Penn, which in its law instituting liberty of conscience also restricts any reproachful or reviling words in matters pertaining to religion. And you actually get a very, very similar statute in the fundamental constitutions of the colony of Carolina. And these are particularly interesting because none other than John Locke had a hand in drafting those constitutions. So the point is simply that, you know, even for those few people in this period who are principled defenders of religious toleration, even they think that religious toleration does not entail free speech. Quite the opposite. They think that religious toleration demands restrictions on speech if you want people to be able to go along and get along in a religiously diverse society.
Okay, and I want to turn to the main characters of your book, but I'd like to treat them in order of their permissiveness towards speech, if you like, because there are some very decisive differences between them. And I think it would be difficult to find someone more hostile to the idea of free speech than Thomas Hobbes, as you document with some truly remarkable quotes from Hobbes. He finds, for instance, that the mere act of disagreement is offensive. And I nearly dropped my jaw when I read this particular Hobbes quote, which is rather long, so bear with me. To err, to be deceived, or to have a wrong opinion is not a crime in itself, nor can error become a crime so long as it is confined to a person's heart. But words can be a crime and can be punished without injury with whatever punishments the legislators wish, indeed with the ultimate penalty. If blasphemy against the king can be punished by death, much more can blasphemy against God. Wow, that's pretty harsh.
Yeah, I mean, Hobbes was never one to avoid an extreme position.
Why would a heterodox thinker like Hobbes, who himself was accused of atheism and had his books burned, I believe, at the very university where you're sitting right now in Oxford, why would he be in favor of such draconian censorship?
This is one of the, you know, perplexing and vexed questions of Hobbes scholarship, and Hobbes scholars still go back and forth about this today. I mean, it seems strange, right? I mean, as you've just said, Hobbes is a notoriously heterodox thinker. I mean, among the sort of jaw-dropping statements in Leviathan, I mean, obviously to modern ears, the one that you've read just sounds particularly egregious, but imagine to a modern audience how they would have responded when they read in Leviathan that the doctrine of the Trinity is not is not a reference to the persons of God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, but rather of God, Jesus, and Moses. So, you know, in Leviathan, Hobbes does something so crazy as claim that Moses is a member of the Trinity. So how, you know, how is a person who is so manifestly, you know, heterodox at best, atheistical at worst, going to defend such a draconian regime of censorship? I mean, and there are a few things to say here. I mean, one is that Hobbes is a systematic thinker and he has the courage of his convictions. He follows the argument where it leads. I mean, it's his diagnosis of the English Civil Wars as the necessary consequence of religious disagreement of the kind that I was describing earlier. You know, Hobbes thinks it's the fact of these religious disagreements, is the fact that Charles and Laud didn't censor early and often enough on Hobbes's analysis that led to all the problems. So he's really emphatic that the only way that you can have civil peace and avoid the war of all against all is by giving the sovereign an absolute and arbitrary power to determine all questions and terms subject to controversy. And in religion, that means conforming to whatever the sovereign legislates and dictates in matters of religion, and believing, you know, at least professing to believe whatever the sovereign says you should believe.
I mean, he goes so far as saying that it would have been better to kill 1,000 sort of radical preachers to prevent the outbreak of religious wars and thereby save 100,000 people. He admits it would be a massacre, but it would be in order to avoid a worse massacre.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And he means it. He absolutely means it. He thinks that the freedom of speech, the evangelical liberty assumed by these Presbyterian preachers, was the cause of the rivers of blood and the devastation of his country. And because of that, he thinks that, you know, that one has to bite the bullet. What that means is that freedom of speech is not is a recipe for civil war and devastation. And that, so, you know, when it comes to his own, it would seem, you know, Hobbes is a what Hobbes wrote was extremely offensive to a lot of people. But, you know, when it came to defending himself, he was adamant that, look, you know, when I wrote my Leviathan, we were in a period of anarchy. So there was no sovereign dictate about what was to be believed or said in matters of religious or civil doctrine. And so, you know, I was free because we were in a state of civil war. But once the state of civil war is over, I'm willing to profess whatever the sovereign tells me. So, you know, and so, of course, I mean, people didn't find that all that persuasive. And there are moves in the 1660s to burn not only Hobbes's book, which, as you say, was burned in the quadrangle at Oxford, but also, according to his biographer, Aubrey, to burn the old gentleman himself for a heretic.
His comment on Moses as being part of the Trinity would certainly have risked seeing him on the bonfire in Catholic lands.
Absolutely. And it is interesting that when he reissues Leviathan in Latin with an appendix discussing some of its more controversial doctrines, I mean, he really doubles down on most of them, but it's only on the matter of Moses being a member of the Trinity that he backs down on. I think even he realized that was a bridge too far.
If we try to sort of go behind the shock and awe, if you like, of Hobbes' very direct call for censorship and even preventive massacres, could we argue that his attitude of what you call difference without disagreement is actually a form of tolerance? Because he's not arguing like the Catholic Inquisition or in Calvin's Geneva. You know, he's not interested in compelling people to believe in a specific orthodoxy. So everyone can follow their own faith as long as they keep quiet. And he's also, if I'm not mistaken, he's not particularly interested in what constitutes orthodoxy as long as it's sort of upheld and people outwardly conform to it. So isn't that a pragmatic approach in the aftermath of religious warfare that sort of balances the interest of peace and tranquility of the realm with you know, some ability of following your conscience in the security of your own home.
On the one hand, right, we hear Hobbes's defense of censorship, of massacring Presbyterians, and say, oh, my goodness, this just sounds completely, completely intolerant. But on the other hand, as you say, if we think about actually what he's arguing, it begins to sound really familiar and actually really quite close to what we as, you know, denizens of modern sort of secular liberal democracies do think about as a tolerant society. So for Hobbes, I mean, what he's trying to get people to see is that, you know, and is facing a lot of trouble in getting them to see this, he wants them to see their religious differences as, strictly speaking, matters of indifference, right? They're just not worth disagreeing about. And he thinks that religion should really belong to a private sphere, right? Divorced from the public. I mean, it just so happens that for Hobbes, the private sphere he would sort of define as, you know, as the insides of one's own particular skull. I mean, there's no right to manifest your particular religious persuasion outside of your own head. But even so, you know, he does have a sense that thought is free. You know, the liberty of conscience is kind of unrestrainable in some ways because you're free necessarily to think whatever you happen to think. The problem comes when you presume to manifest those thoughts publicly. And so this ideal that, as you say, as I describe my book, is an ideal of difference without disagreement. I mean, for Hobbes, the problem really isn't diversity. The problem is the disagreements that we have about that diversity. So if we could have a culture where people just didn't take religion so seriously, if they didn't take their differences so seriously, if they could see that all of this is just really indifferent, then we could live side by side in peace and not destroy one another in war. And so that idea, you know, in among scholars, this has become kind of known as the tolerant Hobbes. Actually, Hobbes seems in this way to be a kind of forerunner of what we might think of as a kind of modern secularist mindset. And it is, I mean, it's here, it's just crucial to point out that although Hobbes sounds incredibly intolerant in a lot of ways, he's emphatic that the sovereigns reasons for restricting religious practice or religious speech will always be secular and civil reasons. So the problem with him saying that Moses is a member of the Trinity isn't that that's unorthodox. It's that that kind of unorthodoxy is a violation of a kind of public conformity or uniformity, right? And so, you know, he says in his famous discussion of Galileo, in Leviathan, he says, you know, the problem with the treatment of Galileo by the Inquisition was that it was ecclesiastics. It was the church that was presuming to censor him in his pursuit of philosophy. But if it had been the state, if it had been the civil sovereign, there'd be no problem. As he says, for disobedience lawfully be punished in them that against the laws teach even true philosophy. Well, that's fine, right? So civil censorship is fine. It's the religious censorship. It's the religious domination. It's this trying to look inside of men's souls and see inside of their skulls that he abhors and that he thinks is the enemy to a peaceful and civil society.
I want to move on because we've already spent a lot of time and we're far from done with the with the main characters of your book. And of course, no one is more celebrated as sort of the intellectual godfather of tolerance and natural rights than John Locke, who in his letter concerning toleration argues that it's not for the magistrate to interfere with the conscience of individuals in matters of religion. But you argue that what we think of as the Lockean position is a constant work in progress and that Locke actually started out something as a Hobbesian almost. Can you tell us more about how and why Locke changes towards a more tolerant attitude towards religious freedom?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the surprising things to realize that, you know, Locke, who's famous to us as the author of A Letter Concerning Toleration and kind of, often is described as the father of liberalism, you know, his first works, which were unpublished during his lifetime, but his first works written in 1660 when he was a student at Christ Church College, Oxford, are avowedly Hobbesian tracts against religious toleration. In fact, you know, so arguing the kind of Hobbesian conformist line against the liberty of conscience. And so understanding how this young man at Christchurch, enamored of the philosophy of Thomas Hobbes and arguing against the claims to liberty being made by some of his contemporaries, becomes the kind of father of liberalism that we think we know and hopefully love of 1689 is a really interesting one. And, you know, and scholars still go back and forth about it, but I would just point to a couple key factors. I mean, the first is that, you know, Locke's early intolerant writings are written just at the time of the restoration of the monarchy. So this experiment with republican government and then the protectorate of Oliver Cromwell famously, you know, goes to pot. Charles I's son, Charles II, is welcomed in and the monarchy is restored. And as part of that restoration, there's enacted an incredibly repressive regime trying to undo the de facto religious toleration that had taken place in England during the so-called interregnum. And so it's sort of what becomes known as the Clarendon Code, enacted various things, including restrictions on private religious meetings, restrictions on Quakers in particular. But in any event, you know, it seems clear that Locke is impressed by this legal agenda, but mostly because of its failure to actually deal with the problem. You know, he seems to come to see that actually once the genie's out of the bottle, you're not going to be able to put it back in with by a policy of intolerance. But a second key point is that, you know, later in the 1660s, Locke leaves Oxford for the first time. And so you can imagine a young man who's sort of grown up in a university, sort of seeing academics squabbling and having these incredibly bitter feuds, and, you know, nothing has changed. I can tell you that. But he goes, he travels around Europe and he visits the town of Cleves, where he witnesses for the first time not only different kinds of Protestants living together in peace, but also Protestants and Catholics living together in peace. And he writes a famous letter. You know, he's really shocked to see that those who are divided so fundamentally in religion are living side by side and getting along as neighbors. And so really it's this long story of from 1660 to 1689, where we finally get Locke's kind of mature toleration position. But it is worth just saying that what we know today as the letter concerning toleration was actually an English translation of a pamphlet that Locke had actually written earlier in 1685 in Latin, in response to the revocation of the Edict of Nantes. So it's only when a kind of mature Locke, who's living in exile in the Netherlands, sees the horrors of the persecution of Huguenots in 1685, who are being dragooned and expropriated and imprisoned and executed in France, that Locke comes to his kind of mature position about the separation of church and state and the individual rights of conscience.
And so this is when we reach sort of peak Locke, if you like, on tolerance. This is where he writes, quote, "No man can so far abandon the care of his own salvation as blindly to leave the choice of any other, whether prince or subject, to prescribe to him what faith or worship he shall embrace. For no man, if he would, conform his faith to the dictates of another. All the life and power of true religion consists in the inward and full persuasion of the mind, and faith is not faith without believing." And then at the same time also sort of insisting very strictly that the power of civil government relates only to men's civil interest and not to sort of what goes on inside your head about religious matters, but also that you have the right to express that outwardly. That's where he sort of breaks with Hobbes.
Right. You can see there the continuity on the one hand with the Hobbesian position, saying that, you know, the civil magistrate has a right to regulate actions, but Hobbes just breaks with so Locke breaks with Hobbes in terms of where he draws the boundary of the private sphere. Basically, he says that for those who are convinced that a certain form of worship, right, or a certain kind of religious meeting is essential for their salvation, they will never be convinced that such things are a matter of indifference. And because of that, because of the passionate strength of their believing, the sovereign needs to tolerate those things and grant them liberty therein. But there's still, I mean, again, I would say that, you know, it's still the position remains fundamentally Hobbesian in the sense that in the end, in the breach, when these things come into conflict, the civil magistrate and secular authorities trump the claims of conscience. And that's where, you know, we can see the Lockean position as a kind of combination of the sort of Hobbesian position on the one hand and the kind of Miltonian or Miltonic position on the other.
The letter is peppered with these classic and celebrated quotes like the ones that I just quoted. But it seems that you're rather less impressed with Locke than his impressive reputation. You even go so far as arguing that when it comes to the development of religious tolerance, Locke was, and I quote, and this really made me chuckle, was a junior partner in an enterprise begun centuries before. So what is it about Lockean tolerance that rubs you the wrong way?
Right. One point in the book, I call Locke, you know, I say that Locke must be the villain, right? And I've been, many of my colleagues have given me a hard time about this. I mean, look, when I say that Locke is the junior partner, in that case, I really do just mean that he is junior to many of the other figures that I consider, primarily Roger Williams, but also Hobbes. I mean, Locke is born in 1632. He comes of age during the Civil War. And he matures intellectually after the Restoration. And so when he's making his own arguments for toleration, he really is drawing on a rich store of arguments made by radicals like Milton and also Roger Williams before him, and kind of amalgamating them with these kind of Hobbesian, secular status kind of arguments as well. But you're right that there's also a kind of sense in which I find Lockean toleration wanting. And partly that's a kind of reaction to just the, what some scholars have termed the Locke obsession in toleration studies, this idea that somehow religious toleration was the kind of discovery of John Locke in 1689, when that's really just not, that's just not right. There are very few original arguments in the letter concerning toleration. Certainly, what's original is the way that Locke brings all of these arguments together and puts them in this sort of characteristically powerful prose. Although, again, it must be said that the English of the letter, you know, the sort of wonderful phrases that you've been reading, is not Locke's. It's actually the translation made by Locke's associate, William Popple. So many of the kind of most Lockean dicta about religious toleration that we know and love today are actually the words of William Popple. It's a kind of interesting question how much Popple has radicalized the position that Locke is defending in the Latin letter. And where questions like this become really important when we come to the question of the limits of Locke's toleration. And here I just say that Locke's toleration, in fact, like Milton's, was quite a lot more limited than a lot of his modern Whig inheritors have tended to celebrate or remember. So it's crucial to remember the limits.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting question because I'm a little bit confused, not only because, as you said, Locke had something like 9 different intellectual lives, but also the letter in itself is not completely clear on this, at least not in my reading. So can we try to sort of get our heads around who were to be tolerated and who not? I mean...
Mm-hmm. Right. You might think that surely it should be absolutely clear, right? So at one point in the letter, he tells us, you know, and I quote sort of, "Nay, if we may openly speak the truth as becomes one man to another, neither pagan nor Mahometan nor Jew ought to be excluded from the civil rights of the Commonwealth because of his religion." So there we get a really plain statement that the scope of the toleration is really quite radical. It's he's proposing to tolerate non-Christians and put them on terms of civic equality with Christians in his Commonwealth. So that is incredibly radical. That's not a mainstream position. But at the same time, Locke is quite clear elsewhere in the letter that the toleration he's proposing isn't unlimited. And some of the particular limits may not surprise us. So in the first case, he suggests that he doesn't name Catholics by name, but he gives us this kind of famous analogy to followers of the, quote, Mufti of Constantinople, by which he seems to mean the Pope. But basically anyone who thinks that their religious allegiances also also impact or trouble or trump their civil allegiances is not to be tolerated. So those who think that that basically Catholics who are loyal to the Pope over their Protestant monarchs are absolutely intolerable on his point of view.
In your footnote on this, you write that you take this to actually be referring to Muslims as well as Catholics, but not be sort of pure code for Catholic. Do I remember right?
Yeah, I think we need to take seriously the fact that Locke doesn't say Catholics there. He doesn't say the Pope. He's formulating it in a kind of abstract way to make the point that it's not Catholicism as such that's the problem. It's this particular belief held by many Catholics, but also some Turkish Muslims. So we really want to put our finger on, okay, what's the belief and what's the problem with it? And the problem, this problem of allegiance for Locke, is just one of a kind of constellation of beliefs that he associates with Roman Catholicism, but also sees in other religions, that make the adherents fundamentally untrustworthy in some way. So the problem with followers of the Pope or followers of the Ottoman Mufti is that they are not trustworthy as citizens. And this is, again, this leads him to object to atheists on similar grounds. So the problem with the reason that you cannot tolerate an atheist, according to Locke, is because you cannot trust them to keep their promises, right? He says the taking away of God, but even in thought, dissolves all. So for Locke, the limits of toleration are defined in terms of those who can be a trustworthy member of the body politic, and that, you know, leaves Catholics, some Muslims, and atheists out in the cold. Now, some defenders of Locke have tried to argue, okay, well, this sounds bad, but really the important thing here is to notice that Locke's reasons for not tolerating, much like Hobbes's, are secular reasons. Right, we might disagree with his judgment of Catholic doctrine, but really the objection is that Catholics are bad citizens, not that there's anything kind of heretical or wrong with their doctrines. But to that I would say yes, but also the Locke's really clear that, and this is I think where he deviates from Hobbes quite significantly and in a kind of really problematic way. The problem isn't their actions, right? The problem is their beliefs. So I think, my argument really is that Lockean toleration sort of reintroduces through the back door a kind of sense that certain beliefs are beyond the pale in a tolerant society. So atheism, ideas of papal supremacy, but also later on he'll say, that the intolerant themselves have no claim to toleration, so that all churches need to preach the duty of toleration from their pulpits. So again, he seems to be saying that there will actually be some role for the sovereign to regulate what's being preached in the churches in his tolerant society.
Okay, the hero of your book, of course, is Roger Williams, who is considerably less famous than Hobbes and Locke or Milton, for that sake. And I have to confess openly, I hadn't heard of him until I met his rather aggressive pen on the pages of your book. So perhaps you could start off by giving a short bio of Williams and his tumultuous life.
I will also confess that before I started doing my PhD, I hadn't heard of Williams either. But basically, Roger Williams was the founder of the colony of Rhode Island, and he is just a really fascinating guy. He's one of this early generation of English Puritans who emigrate to the British colonies of North America in the 1630s. So at the time that Charles I and Archbishop Laud are kind of cracking down on Puritanism within the Church of England, Williams and others are kind of migrating across the Atlantic to be able to live in a place where they can worship freely. But what kind of sets Williams apart from all of the other Puritans who are doing this is just what his contemporaries might call the strength of his zeal. So basically, Williams, as soon as he gets off the boat in Boston, he is asked to become a teacher in the local church, which is a great honor, but which William unceremoniously declines by accusing the local Puritans of being insufficiently separated from the Church of England and thus themselves tainted with anti-Christian, that is Catholic, corruption. So basically Williams's point is because the congregations of New England aren't formally separated from the Church of England, they are still basically tainted by association with the Catholic Church. So this is a really extreme Puritan position, and Williams really doesn't endear himself to anyone. He also makes himself notorious by, he moves to Salem because he thinks that people are more Christian there. Salem, which will be famous for its witch trials in a few decades. He argues that women should wear veils in public. I mean, he's a real, what today we would describe as a real fundamentalist. But what's fascinating about Williams is that he's too Puritan for his fellow Puritans, and he keeps on insisting on publicizing his disagreements with them, publishing pamphlets, including one defending the American Indians, arguing that the English have stolen their land, right? And finally, it gets too much for his English neighbors, and they vote to banish him back to England. He manages to escape in the middle of the night, and he goes into hiding with some of the local tribes, first the Wampanoag and then the Narragansett. And really, that begins Williams's career as a colonial founder. So because of his close friendship with the Narragansett Indians, he ends up being gifted the land on which he'll found the town of Providence. And basically what ends up happening is that all of the other religious radicals and castaways who have been similarly ejected from other colonies find their way to Rhode Island, and kind of in spite of himself, Roger Williams ends up founding the most tolerant society that the world had ever seen.
You also write that for Williams, the ongoing war of words was not a form of persecution, but rather the essence of toleration. And he, of course, was the one who coined the phrase mere civility, which is the title of your book. What did he mean by that?
To a modern audience, all that I've just described will sound really, really intolerant, right? A kind of really intolerant form of religious fundamentalism. And it's true that Williams is hugely intolerant when it comes to matters of religion. But at the same time, because of the uncompromising nature of his religious beliefs, and these are evangelical beliefs, he at the same time has a really strong sense of the fallenness of this world and the duty of Christians to evangelize for their beliefs and to save their own souls and the souls of their fellow fallen creatures. And so Williams, it's an interesting fact that Williams is close personal friends with Milton, they're friends at Cambridge, when Williams comes back to England in 1643 to try to get a patent for his colony, Milton is the one who hooks him up with a publisher. So Williams has in common with Milton this sense of a certain kind of freedom of speech being a demand of the liberty of conscience. And so in my book, I call this kind of evangelical liberty, the idea that religious toleration demands a kind of freedom of speech so that people can compete for converts and try to persuade other people. But a consequence of this is that, you know, the very threatening kinds of wars of words, what another contemporary of Williams will call the persecution of the tongue, i.e. religious insults, the kind of things that so scandalized his contemporaries, that is going to be a permanent feature of a tolerant society. That's a feature, not a bug, of a tolerant society. So basically, toleration, you know, if we want a tolerant society, we shouldn't make a fetish of people getting along, being harmonious outwardly, not insulting each other. Instead, we should be wanting to supply the conditions and the freedom where people can insult each other, because that's just a function of people evangelizing for their deeply held beliefs and, you know, doing their duty to God.
So he combines extreme evangelical Christianity with extreme commitment to religious free speech, you could say.
Yeah, I mean, and it's Williams that we get the position that I think can really be justly called a free speech fundamentalist position. I think Williams is better than, you know, it's better than, but, you know, Williams is more principled than Milton on this one. He thinks that any attempt to restrict what he calls the word of God, the word of the Lord, is a violation of, one, the separation of church and state, and two, the liberty of conscience of the individual.
To sort of modern radical free speech defenders who might have as their patron saint an atheist like Christopher Hitchens, who combined sort of the rejection of religion and the defense of freedom of thought, Williams' radical toleration born out of a fierce Puritan conviction might seem like a contradiction and very counterintuitive. Could you flesh it out for us?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that motivated me in writing the book, and one of the reasons I'm so pleased to be able to come on this podcast, is because I think that for many modern libertarians, many modern liberals, there's a kind of assumption that individual liberty goes hand in hand with a rejection of organized religion. And this is a kind of old association, the idea that tolerance is necessarily a kind of anti-clerical kind of a movement or position. And I think that what's really interesting about Williams is that he really brings into sharp focus how contingent that assumption, that connection really is. And I think basically, you know, here we see a really strong division between the kind of, you know, progress, if you will, you know, in scare quotes, of toleration in America and its, you know, quote unquote progress in Europe. I think that, you know, in Europe, the impetus seems to come more, not exclusively, but more from, you know, the enlightened denizens of the Republic of Letters, philosophers, moderate and radical Enlightenment thinkers. Whereas in America, sort of following in Williams' footsteps, really, the push for separating church and state really comes from radical evangelical sectarian Christians, Congregationalist Christians. And so what I like about Williams is that he shows us that this assumption that kind of free thought, i.e. secular or sort of anti-religious thought, and free speech can go together, but they needn't necessarily, as the example of Hobbes shows us very well. And similarly, strong fundamentalist religious belief and a desire to censor can go together, as we've seen in many of the characters in your podcast thus far, but they needn't necessarily. And sometimes the most persuasive arguments for freeing not only men's consciences but their tongues are coming precisely from the, you know, quote unquote religious fundamentalists.
Fantastic. So Williams' most famous work was the Bloody Tenet of Persecution, which was actually ordered burned by the English Parliament, if I'm correct.
Yeah. So, I mean, the bloody tenet of persecution for cause of conscience is an absolute barn burner that itself gets burned, as you say, by the Long Parliament. I mean, so Williams was back in London visiting his old pal Milton, and, you know, taking advantage of the relaxation of censorship to publish all of his own writings. And so what's really interesting about the Bloody Tenet is again the radical scope of the toleration that Roger Williams is defending. So for Williams, it's not just different kinds of Protestants that are deserving of toleration, but as he says, pagans, Jews, Mohammedans, and anti-Christians. And, you know, so who does he mean by anti-Christians? Well, he means Catholics. So Williams, you know, 50 years before Locke and contemporaneously with Milton, is saying we can absolutely tolerate Catholics, and we should in a tolerant society. So this is what's so exciting about Williams, is that, you know, for, you know, instead of, I would say, you know, instead of just focusing on Locke, what we want to understand is how someone 50 years earlier, who was such a sort of strong Puritan and religious believer in his own right, could imagine a tolerant society in which, you know, not only Protestants and non-Christians, but also Catholics could live side by side together on terms of equal liberty, all evangelizing for their different persuasions.
Okay, I think we have to wrap up. I've kept you for more than an hour. I'm going to ask you a rather disingenuous question. we've heard how a number of influential 17th century thinkers thought and wrote about religious tolerance and free speech. But so what? I mean, why should people in the 21st century living in very different settings care what Hobbes, Locke, and Williams had to say about free speech? I mean, they didn't have social media or live in modern multicultural democracies.
Right. It's an important question. It's an important question that one needs to ask, and one should always be prepared to answer. I mean, I think there are two points I'd make. I mean, one point is just that familiarity with the past will always be a helpful way of reminding ourselves that whatever the particular challenges we are facing in the present are, they tend to be much less novel than we think. So no problem really is unprecedented, I would say. I think that as you've brought out again in the podcast, a lot of the modern hand-wringing that we have about social media and the internet and new technologies of communication really closely follow the script set by those wringing their hands about the printing press and Luther's invention of polemical pamphleteering in the 16th century. So, you know, with Aristotle and Ecclesiastes, I think history is a way of just reminding us that there is really nothing new under the sun. So that's one thing. But the second thing, and I think this is the really key one, is that studying the history of political thought helps us to see that the arguments that we today in our own society take as most obvious and ours are often a lot less obvious and a lot more interesting, I'd say, than we think. And here I think just the primacy of free speech in the modern liberal imagination and the close connection we assume between the freedom of speech on the one hand and religious toleration on the other. If, you know, looking at these matters historically, we see that the connection between those principles is less tight and more contingent than modern liberals have been inclined to assume. And so as a modern liberal myself, then I take this as a helpful reminder and an opportunity to do some thinking for myself and try to come up with better arguments and better ways of defending the principles that I see as essential for a tolerant society.
And speaking about your own thinking about free speech, contrary to someone like Jeremy Waldron, who's also done a lot of thinking about free speech, including thinking on Locke and others, you end up rejecting hate speech laws, whereas Jeremy Waldron has defended hate speech laws in his book, The Harm of Hate Speech, for instance. I assume you're not opposed to the ideal of civility. So what is it about laws against hate speech and offense that alarms you so?
I'm on the record and will repeat again that I am in favor of civility. But yeah, no, you're right. There is a pretty profound disagreement between me and Waldron on this point. And I think my position is a kind of a simple one, which is just that historical awareness and historically informed political theorizing allow us to see ways in which certain favored solutions to contemporary problems have been tried before and failed. And I think that hate speech laws are an excellent example of this. I mean, if you look at the implementation and enforcement of these laws in the American colonies, they were used, as is, you know, this is the case I would argue today, often to suppress the speech precisely of those vulnerable groups that they were enacted to protect. Interestingly, I think, you know, in the book, I argue that Locke himself seems to have come to somewhat of this realization. So from his early association with the religious insult statute in the Fundamental Constitutions of Carolina, later on, he'll criticize Pennsylvania for enacting a religious insult statute, arguing that such matters are, that such laws are matters for, quote, perpetual prosecution and animosity. And it's that sense of seeing the ways in which practice very often frustrates solutions that would seem to be perfect and work in theory, that I would say is just, you know, one of the most valuable things about doing historically informed theoretical work.
Teresa, it's been an absolute privilege to have you on. I have learned so much, and I think our listeners will be extremely grateful for your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for doing this podcast. It's a tremendous resource and a real pleasure to listen to.
Thank you.